Today we will be reviewing the budget of the courts. We'll start with the tax court and then move on to the other court. We have set aside time on Thursday for civil legal services and public defenders. And if we need an extra day, we'll have to stretch into the following week. We still have not heard the final budget presentations from the Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Safety, but we're on time and on schedule, and we have enough time to get through everybody's budgets. And then, members, if I could have someone move the minutes to February 19th.
So moved.
Representative Ward moves the minutes of February 19th. Is there any discussion, additions, corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. With that, we have the Honorable Judge George Perez to lead things off, walk us through the tax court. However you want to proceed with your presentation, welcome, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is George Perez. I'm the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. To my right is Lisa Feister. She's the Court Administrator. The Tax Court is comprised of six employees. We have three judges and three staff. We have statewide jurisdiction over tax matters. We hear two types of cases, primarily commissioner cases, as well as property tax appeals, which involve valuation, classification, equalization, and exemption cases. The judges travel throughout the state to hear trials where the taxpayers are located. The governor has recommended a budget of $825,000 per year, or 1.65 per biennium. And we agree with that recommendation. I think in addition to our function, I would just add some of the trends that we have seen. I think it's familiar to many of the members here that when the economy is down, there's more filing of cases in general, and that's certainly no exception in the tax court. In 2006, we had over 2,300 filings. In 2007, that number went up to 2,400. In 2008, that number went up by even a greater amount to 2,900. And we expect the 2009 projections to come around 3,400 cases filed with the tax court. There is a fee that is charged to individuals that file with the tax court. That fee is set by the legislature. It is currently at $140 for regular division cases and $240 for regular division cases and $150 for small claims. If we total that amount for the 2009 projection, that would yield $818,550 in terms of revenue.
Judge, can you repeat that?
Yeah, the total amount?
Yeah.
The total amount that would be yield for the 2009 year is projected to be at $818,550. And again, our budget is $825,000 per year.
And Judge, just a question on the fee. So what is the level where it stops being a small claims matter?
At $10,000.
$10,000. And have you ever considered adjusting that?
Well, again, that is a statutory decision that is made by the legislature.
Let me rephrase that. Has the legislature ever adjusted that for inflation?
They have over the years. And while we don't take a position on it one way or the other, there have been instances where raising it certainly provides greater access to justice, greater efficiency in the process of cases, because that number is now considered quite low.
And do you know when the last time the legislature adjusted it?
You're talking about the threshold?
Yep.
For? I think it's probably been about 6 years.
Thank you. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a follow-up to your questioning. If we were to raise the threshold, the fee for the higher threshold would actually be cheaper. Does it cost more to do a small claims versus the other type, or is the other type more expensive? I just want to make sure that it would actually result in a saving of money.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, it's the other way around. If you file in small claims, it's $150.
Mm-hmm.
If you file in regular division, it'll be $240. What I would point out also is that, and again, I don't take a position on this one way or the other, but the fees have been raised each biennium the last couple of sessions. And certainly if it went up by even $10, then our projection would be over $900,000, probably perhaps even higher.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would support raising that in the event that it then didn't result in the tax court having a deficit, because, again, if you're collecting fewer fees because more folks are in the small claims side of it, I don't want to create a deficit. So my question is, does it cost you less to do the small claims cases, which is why we charge a smaller fee, so it would be a benefit?
Judge Perez.
Mr. Chair. Madam Representative, yes, it does cost less to do small claims. There are many times when matters should be in small claims, but because the amount is what it's set at, it prevents the taxpayer from being able to move forward in the small claims. The small claims procedure is much quicker, it's more efficient, it's more informal, and it lends itself better to the process of your average taxpayer. So that's really where they belong. And I think that over the years they've been getting priced out because the controversy amount has been growing and growing, but yet it's something that could be handled in small claims if the threshold were raised.
Mr. Chair, one final question is, would you have access to the amounts that other states have, or could you get this committee the amount so that we know if we are really low compared to other states, or where we are, so we could make a decision about what the threshold should be?
Judge Press.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, absolutely we can get through those amounts, and we can check and do a survey of the Midwest, the West, East, and South, and take a look at many of the other states. We are also very fortunate that we have a tax court. There are some states that don't, and the result is that their fees vary from county to county. So we will check. There's at least half the states that have tax courts, so we will look into those jurisdictions and provide the information to your chair and to the members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed, Judge.
Well, actually, I'm just about finished. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Perez, I'm kind of curious about the travel issue. You say the court travels around and around the state to be more available to the litigants, and I certainly think that's a valuable service, but I'm kind of wondering in these tight times, how much of your budget goes toward that? Could you talk a little bit about that? How much extra time does it take? Have you thought about having the litigants come to you? Because, let's face it, in the life of a taxpayer, it's probably a pretty rare thing to have a tax appeal or a tax case. We're not such an enormous state that we couldn't ask somebody to come to St. Paul to do that. So could you talk about that decision-making a little bit?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, I'd be happy to. Our budget, as as it was last year, and it's being recommended by the governor this year for $825,000. I would say about $3,000 is about what we would spend for any year to travel around the state. And again, it's by statute that the petitioner has the right to hear the case in the jurisdiction in which the property is venued. But I'll tell you, many times there are taxpayers that would be happy to come to the Twin Cities, but then the ultimate decision falls on the county attorney that is less than willing to travel to the Twin Cities, and they make the ultimate call that the case should be heard where the property is venued. With commissioner cases, we have a little bit more flexibility because there is no issue of property. It's merely taxes that we're talking about and liability or a refund on behalf of the taxpayer. So in those cases where there isn't that regulation or requirement, many times we hear the cases in St. Paul. We've also implemented several other procedures where we have pretrial conference calls to make sure that the case is going to go forward so that we don't make a trip and there is no case or it gets settled. We've implemented policies and procedures to ensure that. We've experimented with televised trials. We've done that in small claims. We've also tried telephonic when there are motions. It's only when there's going to be a regular division, full-fledged trial, and it's going to go on for 3 or 4 days that it really requires us to be there in person to see the witnesses on the witness stand and hear the case and take in all the evidence and the arguments. But for many other procedures, we try to do them telephonically or by televised. And I would say that we probably average maybe 2 trips per judge per year in terms of, and a lot of our cases are in the Twin City areas, primarily in the southern counties. There are cases that we'll have outstate. Those are a little bit less common. So even though we're required to go to all 87 counties, it doesn't happen as often as one would imagine.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions?
The only follow-up I would have, if I may, sure, is if the statute were to be amended to give, say, the taxpayer the full ability to choose rather than to say where the property is venued, because by saying where the property is venued, then the county attorney can simply make a motion and say, I request to have the hearing here because that's where the property is venue. When both parties waive that, and we have had instances where parties will waive that and the county attorney will come to the Twin Cities, we have some that do that. But even some in nearby counties will simply not want to make that trek. And there are times when all the attorneys, all the experts, all the witnesses, and sometimes even the taxpayer are all residing within the Twin Cities. But if the county attorney wants it held where the property is venue, then that's what's going to prevail.
So, Judge, we'd need a statutory change to say what? Writing it down.
Well, to allow the taxpayer to choose the venue.
Okay.
And I can provide something in writing. There's something already in the statute when it comes to commissioner cases. And this would probably just make it parallel with the commissioner, because the two are, at this point, not parallel. They're a little bit at odds, but I can provide that.
That would be helpful. Thank you. We have a question for you before we let you go, Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, kind of on that same line, is there any benefit to allowing that statutory flexibility for that small claims threshold? And maybe that's a dumb question from a non-attorney, but, you know, I know you're going to be doing some research for Representative Hillstrom on where those limits are for other states, and I'm wondering, you know, if a taxpayer is able to be savvy enough to make a choice about venue, maybe they're savvy enough to make a choice about, you know, this is slightly over that threshold, but I'd rather have it heard in small claims court than somewhere else.
Judge Perez.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, if I understand your question correctly, you're saying, will the taxpayer be savvy enough to understand that if the threshold was raised, would he take advantage of putting it in small claims, filing this case in small claims?
Mr. Chair, Judge, I guess my question was versus setting a hard limit in statute, can we offer that flexibility to a petitioner of making the choice?
Judge Perez.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I believe that a statute language could be constructed to achieve that. I think that the first thing that taxpayers look at when they file, especially if they're potentially small claims litigants, is the price, is the cost. So if the small claims cost remains at $150 and is different than what it would be for a regular division, that's usually the first step in them making a decision. And we have handouts and material available both in writing and on the website that explains thoroughly what the advantages are to file in small claims versus in regular division.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was, is there ever a benefit when you go travel? Do you ever go look at the property? That would make sense if you might have to go look at the property, that you would hold the court where the property is located.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes, there are times when we do go look at the property, and I've had a recent case in the last couple of years where we did go out and view the property. It was a large compound. It covered thousands of acres, and it made all the sense in the world to go look at it. And interestingly enough, in that case, all of the attorneys were from the Twin Cities, including the county who had hired out private attorneys, so we actually had it in St. Paul. And it worked really well because it was almost a two-week trial. So even though we had to travel to the particular county, that was a one-day excursion to spend there, and then we came back and tried it in the Twin Cities. So in answer to your question, yes, there are times when it's valuable to see the property.
Representative Ola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is more a comment than it is a question. Having been probably the only one that's been in tax court as a county attorney many years, more than one occasion. And I'm going to give two comments. The one's going to be quickly, there was a time and there is still times when some county attorneys are sole practitioners and they're the only person in the office. And I can think of it at least one instance where I went past one day. I went into a two-day trial, and if I had been a sole practitioner at that time, basically the county of Pennington would not have been represented. And also, if you need to take your county assessor and other records with, some of those offices don't have two people either. So it's basically closing down the small county operation if they do end up having to go to the city.
You want to respond, Jeff?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I don't disagree with that. I think there's a range in this state, in the 87 counties, that we have a range of very large counties to very small counties. And there are certainly going to be hardships placed on certain counties, and there are hardships placed on certain taxpayers. And I think that's part of the balancing that goes on. And, perhaps I always strive to read the perfect statute, and I know that this committee strives to write the perfect statute, and there's a lot of interests that have to be balanced, and sometimes it favors one or the other a little bit more. And maybe I should give it more thought to see if there's some way to write something that would give some flexibility to both sides so that in cases where it would make sense to have it in that county, to actually go to that county, that it would be the least burden on everyone if it was in that county, versus in other cases where the least burden would be if it was in the Twin Cities or in St. Paul.
And we'll look forward to seeing that. Representative Haas.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to get clarity from anybody if they can answer this. When a citizen goes to small claims court, they can exceed their request can exceed the threshold, but the judge's award cannot exceed the threshold. Isn't that correct?
Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, it's the threshold that the controversy is involved in. So If the controversy involves more than $10,000 at the outset, then that's going to dictate where the taxpayer is going to file his or her claim. If the amount is lower than that, then the taxpayer has the option of filing in small claims or filing in regular division.
Just one more clarity, because I've been in small claims courts a few times, and the way I recall it is that the people can actually have a claim that is in excess of that threshold, but the judge can only award the threshold and lower. That is not correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, in tax court, that is not the case.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, Judge, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Mr. Stahl, we're ready for you. Mr. Stahl, welcome to the committee. I don't know how you have this set up for your presentation. I've got a list of presenters, but maybe why don't you start and tell us what your plan is for going through the budget books, or if you're going to use a PowerPoint presentation, I guess.
Mr. Chair and members of the division, thanks very much. My name is Sue DelSalle. I'm the State Court Administrator. And I am here along with a number of witnesses to describe kind of our current budget situation, talk about the potential consequences of your budget decisions for the next biennium, and then as time permits, talk about some of the efficiencies that we have undertaken in recent years. So I'm going to start by kind of setting the context for our current budget situation. Then we're going to talk about the governor's recommendation and its impact. We'll go to cover our FY 10-11 budget request. And then, as I said, end with the initiatives if there's time. With me at the table are Chief Judge Jim Swenson of the 4th Judicial District, Hennepin County, and to his left, Judge John Rodenberg, who is a 5th Judicial District judge and vice chair of our Judicial Council. And we're going to do a little tag team in presenting this first part of the budget. So let me start by setting this context. The judicial branch has been underfunded for the last 6 years. In the last recession, 2004-05, just as we were bringing over the largest of our judicial districts into state funding, we ended up coming out of that that session with about a $23 million shortfall. In 2004-05, there was no restoration of any of that funding, and then in this current biennium now, we're operating with a $19 million shortfall. Now, what have we been doing to close the gap of that $19 million? We have been operating with a 9% short of the staff we need. We've implemented a voluntary separation program, a voluntary leave without pay, where employees are going without salaries and for a certain period of time, about $250,000. We've instituted layoffs. We've had a hiring freeze for permanent employees. And now we're holding open judge vacancies. There are currently 4 judge vacancies that are going to that are open indefinitely. We think by the end of this fiscal year, there'll be 6 or 7 that will be open on top of 12 judgeships that we need right now.
Mr. Sosna, I'll just stop to ask a question real quick. Get back to slide 2 when you talk about the 06-07 no restoration. I'm assuming you're saying that from 2004-05, you went into the next biennium with a $23 million shortfall. I'm trying to get what that slide means.
What does that mean?
Where it says no restoration, what does that mean?
That means that funding that we had to, that were cut and that we had to absorb, there was no restoration of that. We just continued on with that lower base budget.
Okay, and isn't it true that in 2007 was the year that we added judgeships?
That's correct.
That we added 3 Court of Appeal judge units and 9 trial court judges. So, Mr. Sally, did we not provide funding for those judgeships?
No, those were funded, but what was not funded is the cuts that we took and then the increased cost for employees, current employees, that occurs that we'd have to absorb. So we had to cut other things in order to absorb those increased costs for across-the-board increases and for steps and merits that there was no funding for, inadequate funding for.
Members, you should have in your packet, just, and I just, I'm sorry for interrupting Mr. Sell so quickly here, but you have a chart that lists the spending and FTEs. It gives you a 12-year history. You can take a look at that and see how things have increased in the court system over the years, but I would draw your attention to fiscal year 2007, when we saw a spike in FTEs and a spike in state spending in the courts. And I don't know, Mr. Sell, it would seem like some of that must be attributable to the new judgeships we created.
No question, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that we did get those 10 new judgeships along with the staff that goes with it, so that is an increase. But all I'm saying is that in order to keep the current employees, we have to pay approximately 6% increased cost for those employees. And we were not funded for that amount. We were about $13 million short. So we had to squeeze other places, hold open positions in order to close that gap. So that's right. We have some increase in funding, but then there was not sufficient funding to pay the costs of the current employees. So that's where the shortfall comes.
Please continue.
So in order to deal with this $19 million shortfall that we have in this biennium and the staff shortage that has resulted, these are the kinds of service reductions that have happened. We've had to close public counters half a day a week in a number of counties. We've continued to close what we call satellite facilities. In this last year, we closed the Cottage Grove facility. In the 4th District, we had to terminate or reduce a variety of services. We had to cut the per diem from $20 to $10 for jurors and took cuts to drug courts and to retired judge service. The public defender cuts have, of course, impacted the chips in criminal cases all around the state. And so what we're now seeing with these shortages, inadequate staff, that delays in both criminal and civil cases is building around the state. So with operating 9% short staff and having counters closed half a day a week in counties, we have now a recommendation from the governor for a 5% base cut. And what that means for us is $29.4 million for the biennium of a cut. The governor did recommend funding our mandated services request for about $5.5 million in recognition that we have no control over the demand for these services and that we've just got to pay them. So what does that 5% budget cut translate to? Well, with personnel costs about 85% of our budget and having cut everywhere else, we're looking at staff losses. And again, what this means is about 405 positions we're projecting would be lost in order to take that cut. About 279 of those are to pay for the $29 million base cut. Another 126 positions would go to pay for unavoidable personnel costs that we're going to have to pay in the next biennium. And these are costs just for the current staff for health insurance, which we which projection based on the DOER projections is a 6% per year, statutorily mandated pension increases, and the annualization of our FY09 union contracts and compensation plans. So that's the dilemma we have. Now, we do think that this is probably a worst case scenario. There's 400 positions. It will depend on what kind of turnover we have between now and the end of the fiscal year. The results of our voluntary separation program that we have now, how many people will leave and be able to take those positions, and the number of vacancies we have. But We do believe that this 5% cut would have an impact of somewhere between 10 and 15% reduction in our staff on top of the shortages that we already have. So our number one budget priority is no cut to an already unfunded, underfunded base budget. And to talk a little bit now,
Mr.
about...
Before you turn it over,
yes.
So if, are you presupposing that the a dollar amount based on projected salary negotiations with the unions in this dollar? I understand the pensions and the healthcare costs. You know, you have no control over that. But is that number built into this?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question, because I should have mentioned that. No, this assumes a zero increase. No ATB, no steps for employees in our union. Now, so that, as you know, the executive branch negotiates and sets the pattern for us in terms of our negotiations. And if the governor and the executive branch can achieve a wage freeze of zero, that certainly will determine how much funding we need. But for these numbers, this is assuming no increase, a zero wage freeze. If there is something more negotiated, and of course we do negotiate, more positions would be lost. So I guess it's not exactly a worst case scenario, but in terms of assuming with that assumption that we're able to achieve a wage freeze, that's the numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so I want to turn this now to Judge Jim Swenson to talk a little bit about what it's like on the ground.
Before we do, okay. Representative Ward had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stoffel, could you just for myself explain the voluntary separation program and who's taking advantage of that? You know, give me some clarification on that, please.
Chair and Representative Ward. The voluntary separation program is to provide an incentive to employees to separate from our service. And what we avoid then are the layoff costs. As you know, they're somewhere between, for every position you lay off, you have to lay off, depending on the salary, somewhere between another third to a half of a position. So we are trying to encourage those who might be thinking about leaving service to do so. And we provide an incentive based on years of service to do that. And that's the program we have now. We've implemented it two times before, once in the last biennium, once earlier last year in January, again, to try and shed some of these positions so that we don't have to be looking at paying additional layoff costs. And that's what we're doing right now.
So, are there certain classifications or employees that are taking more advantage of that than others?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, it is open to all positions except for, I believe that's correct, court reporters and law clerks. Court reporters and law clerks. It's open to all positions, and we have a range of people that have accepted them.
Representative Lesch. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Saul, do these numbers factor in the court's new payables list that you released? I think it was late last year. And if so, what impact does that make on your numbers?
Mr. Saul.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, I think what we have done is just to assume that these are going to help. What he's referring to is that the court, judicial council, has approved adding to our payables list and eliminating the mandatory court appearance of a number of offenses. And this primarily has an impact on the judge time, but we don't think that this is going to have a significant impact on these numbers right now.
Representative Lesch. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I'm clear then, Ms. Dosell, can you state then what the impact would have been had you not imposed that new list?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I would ask Judge Lundberg to answer that.
Mr. Chairman,
Judge Rodenberg, would you introduce yourself for the record?
I will. For the record, my name is John Rodenberg, District Court Judge in the 5th Judicial District, and as Sue indicated, currently serving as Vice Chair of the Judicial Council. Representative Flesch is a very good question, actually. As we were constructing the budget request for this year, one of the considerations we were taking into significant account was the need to try and contain the requests for new judgeships. As Chairman Paymar was referring, there was an expansion of the number of judgeships several years back. The weighted caseload study would suggest right now, is it 9, Sue?
12.
The weighted caseload study, based on past practice, would suggest that the current budget request could legitimately include a request for 12 judgeships. In an effort to contain that, expansion of the payables was one of our strategies to decrease the demand on judge time, so we're not asking for expansion of judgeships at this time.
Okay, just to clarify, I think what I'm hearing is that you guys really don't have any idea what that has saved as of this point. I mean, you're not going to submit a request for 12 new judgeships, but that's probably for other reasons other than this, but all you know is that that's just sort of helped contain your request for additional judges. Is that correct?
Judge Rodenberg. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. Yes, it's a containment. It's only been in effect now for less than 2 months, so there wouldn't be any history upon which to make any long-term conclusions, but it was a strategy which is also consistent with something I'm going to speak about a little bit later, and that is centralizing the processing of payables and, as a long-term strategy, using technologies to enhance the processing of payables statewide. So it's the first piece of some other strategies that we're talking about.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, I just mentioned that I think that what we're dealing with is 99% shortage right now in trying to ease a little bit of that on the staff. So with that, I'll turn it over to Judge Swenson to talk about kind of what is life like right now before any kind of a cut might be considered.
Judge Swenson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm James Swenson. I'm the Chief Judge in Hennepin County. That's the 4th Judicial District. You'll see at the top of the slide two heavy caseloads. I want to put that in perspective for you. In 2001, the Office of the Legislative Audit looked at what your judicial branch does here in Minnesota in comparison to the rest of the Midwest to see whether we were efficient, and found that per judge we were handling over 7,500 cases per year, and our neighbors, all the Midwestern states, was more like 5,000. This last summer, when I became Chief Judge of Hennepin County, I wanted to know what other large urban courts were doing so I could compare courts that have the same type of diversity issues and issues we have. And what we found out is that in Hennepin County, the judges handle over 8,000 cases per year per judge on average, and in other large urban courts around the country, it was less than 5,000. So we're doing substantially more work than our colleagues throughout the country already. The numbers I'm about to share with you are put in context in 2001, when we were working as a state court branch at about a 50% harder clip than our colleagues. This is what's happened since then. You have a couple slides in your packet. One is the slide of our default judgments, and what that shows is that 2001, when you did your audit, through 2006, we had an average of 20,000 default judgments per year. In 2007, that jumped to just shy of 40,000, and in 2008, it jumped even higher to over 51,000. When you have a bad economy, case filings go up. That's a very good example. In your packet, you also have another slide which is just peculiar to Hennepin County, and that's a look at our foreclosures. It's the bottom of that same page on the Torrens part of property. Torrens property is like a certificate of title for a car, as distinct from abstract property. And from 2000 to 2006, you'll see that the proceeding subsequent to the initial registration, when the property is registered, went from an average of 316 to 2,127 in 2008. the work on abandoned property, that's where you have a very short 5-week redemption period for foreclosures, went from an average of 155 per year during those years 2002 to 2006 to over 1,000 now. Another example of our burgeoning caseload in comparison to when you audited us in 2001. We have hearing examiners that deal with a lot of our parking and lower level traffic type matters. In just the last 2 months alone, the number of people coming to hearing examiners is up 16%. The reason for that, if they can shave $20 or $30 off of their ticket, that might help them feed their family. And so you were in our building and you saw the lines outside of the hearing examiner. It's like a crowded bus station waiting to get in. Our housing filings, just dealing with housing issues in 2001 when you audited, were about 8,800. By 2007, they were almost 2,800, a big jump. Our interpreter cases in 1998, I'm sorry I don't have the statistics for 2001. This is just Hennepin County, was 8,382. It jumped all the way up to 14,955 in 2007. The request for Spanish interpreters was up 223% in that time frame. For East African interpreters, it was up 536%. These are very, very labor-intensive cases when we have to have interpreters. And it's not just Hennepin County. When we were up in Detroit Lakes for the opening of their new courtroom, Mike Kirk, the judge up there, said that one of their neighboring communities, I think it was Pelican Rapids, they've now reached the point where in their grade school, more than 50% of the children, English is their second language. So this is a phenomena that we're seeing not just in the urban area, but across the state. Now, what has that meant? All those cases that have been piled on top of what you looked at in 2001. In Hennepin County, it now takes 6 months or more to even get into court for a conciliation court hearing. If you get to court and you successfully obtain an order from me or one of my colleagues for a judgment, it takes 2.5 months to enter that judgment. It used to be 2 weeks. And that's highly problematic. If you you leave your apartment, you need your damage deposit back, it takes you 6 months to get into court, then it takes 2.5 months for the judgment to be entered before you could even begin to try to collect that damage deposit so you can move on to your next apartment. The obverse is true. If you're buying a house and there's a problem on the title and you need to get it cleared up by getting rid of a judgment, you can wait 2.5 months to even have us deal with that. That's causing people to lose mortgages at favorable rates because they can't clear up the title. In our domestic abuse service center, and if you'll remember, the legislature, in order to get a handle on the burgeoning increase of domestic abuse cases in Minnesota, said to the courts, you need to develop forms and you need to have people to help the petitioners fill out those forms so they can get into court quickly. In 2007, in the fall, in responding to our budget cuts, Hennepin County had to make a number of cuts. One of the things we did was decrease two of the people on our domestic abuse service center that helped the litigants do those petitions. And what we found was we'd have at 7:15, 7:30 in the morning, we'd have 20 people already waiting in line to get in to see somebody in the domestic abuse center. A large number of them we couldn't even get to by 1 o'clock, and we'd send them home back to the abusive environment. In Ramsey County, the backlog to enter citations and complaints went from one day in 2007 to as much as 30 days today. In Dakota County in 2000, felony and gross misdemeanor probation violations took 42 days to be scheduled. Now it's 70 days, nearly 3 months that a defendant continues on the street after violating probation. In Olmsted County, they had to stop doing gross misdemeanor pretrials, which had a 65% settlement rate. In Winona, it takes 6 weeks to enter judgments, approaching how bad it is in Hennepin County. In Blue Earth, it takes 120 days for a misdemeanor court trial. I'm going to call on my colleague, John Rodenberg, to talk a little bit more about what's happening in outstate Minnesota.
Judge Rodenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Judge Swenson. I just want to briefly comment that the comments and observations made by Judge Swenson are not limited to the metropolitan area. As Ms. Bissell had noted earlier, there are closed counters not just in the metropolitan area, but there are closed counters
in greater Minnesota as a result of the staff shortages that are ongoing. That can be anticipated to continue and to increase. That means, in real-world terms, that someone coming to a counter in the 3rd Judicial District these days in southeastern Minnesota may have one of those petitions for an ex parte restraining order, may have some filing that requires immediate attention, and they come and find a counter closed. Just yesterday, in my court, I was seeing the effects, as I often do, of the staff shortages that are in place currently. As Ms. LaSalle indicated, we're currently operating approximately 9 or 10% short of what the staffing study would indicate. There are real world consequences of that. When I opened the dissolution file yesterday morning and the attorneys were arguing their respective motions for temporary relief, I found again, as I commonly do these days, that there were filings that had been made, but the affidavits and papers had not made it into the court file. Consequently, the attorneys were arguing about matters that they had exchanged between themselves, but they were not available to me immediately, meaning that we take a break from the proceedings, we shut down the process, I've got, you know, the court reporter, the court clerk, two attorneys, and the parties waiting while we locate that affidavit or make a copy of it, which was the case yesterday. So there are real-world consequences. I like to have reviewed affidavits of that sort before the hearing so that I can make a timely and informed decision. In that case, I'm not able to do that. Yesterday afternoon, the consequences of not having adequate funding for public defenders again reared its head. I had a CHIPS case where the public defender who is being transferred back and forth between counties and is spread pretty thin was not available on time, and consequently my whole juvenile calendar was backing up, and I ended up with approximately 50 people in the hallway of the Brown County Courthouse. Actually, Representative Cornish is probably familiar with that long hallway. And you end up with people who not only need their cases heard and aren't getting them heard timely, but are in a very uncomfortable position. These are people who are divorcing spouses, they're social workers, and parents of children who are in foster care, all confined to a very small area, and this has very real-world effects on people coming into the court system. Additionally, one of the cases that was getting backed up was one involving four children that are in foster care. Those children, I don't know what the outcome will ultimately be, but I think it's fair to say, based upon the slowdown that I was experiencing yesterday, that those four children will be in foster care longer than they would otherwise have been, as we're not able to get through that case as quickly as we could or should. There are real-world consequences throughout the state, including in the rural areas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Judge Swenson speaking again. Some of our statistics, our cases are down, but that's misleading. For example, the juvenile court cases handled in juvenile court are down, but one of the major reasons for that is lack of funding on social service and other areas has compressed the number of cases that are proceeding as CHIPS cases or child in need of protection cases. They don't go away. They go over to family court where they're handled as very complex third-party custody cases where grandma tries to get custody of her daughter's child or in competing with aunt. Those are very hard to handle in family court. Criminal cases in some context look like they're down. Maybe a few fewer homicides in Hennepin County, for example, but what you need to know is what goes on behind those statistics. What we've seen is a trend in criminal courts where, although the statistical number of some crimes are down, the perpetrators has gone up exponentially. Instead of in the old days where if we had 60 homicides, there might have been 60 perpetrators, what you see so often now is in a homicide or an aggravated robbery, you'll have four or five people involved in the assault. What that means to the court is we have one incident which we may have to have four or five trials for. So our workload doesn't necessarily go down when some of the statistics suggest that some things are down. Now, so the next slide talks about the impact on our base and what we can do or what we have to do to respond. You know, we were asked, like everybody else, to look at what the impact of a 10% cut might be. The Judicial Council, which is the policy-making body of the judicial branch and includes judges from all districts and levels as well as court administrators, responded by reviewing all of our 51 case types that we handled and ranked them as high priority, such as people in custody awaiting trials, medium and low priority. In your packet is that list. It looks like this, and it's got them, it's colored with blue. You'll see things that have a designation of an H or an M or an L. And all of these cases are important to those that bring them. They're obviously important to you as legislators because you crafted the legislation that is the vehicle to bringing them to us. Most, if not all of them, are constitutionally required. But the simple fact is, if we were running at 50% more cases per judges in 2001 than our neighbors, and our caseload has gone up substantially, that just means we can't do all the work.
Judge?
Yes, sir.
The Chief Justice brought this to us to show us the impact of the 10% cut.
Yes.
Which we all received some time ago. What you have in your packet is the same handout. And I believe we specifically asked the court to provide us with an updated version so we could see if we followed the governor's recommendations at 5%, what actually this chart would look like relative to high, medium, and low. Did you provide this to the committee?
Mr. Chair, we certainly can do that. We're going to talk about orally what case types we would be able to restore at 5%, but we can certainly provide it in writing.
Thank you.
All right. And what we had to do is look at what a 10% cut would mean in terms of dollars and FTEs and how we could possibly meet that. And that produced the chart that you do have, the impact of the 10% budget reduction, just showing the things that we wouldn't be able to do, wouldn't be able to get out the door with a 10% cut. And with cuts to us and the public defenders, that would mean that most out-of-custody adults and juvenile misdemeanors couldn't be processed. Things like shoplifting, trespass, worthless check, underage drinking all stop in their tracks. Conciliation court, consumer credit, and property-related claims just sit. And the same is true with thousands of traffic and ordinance violations. At a 5% cut, and we went through this exercise at the last Judicial Council, we found we could restore a few things that are on the list. One would be probate cases. Some civil cases would be processed. And instead of stopping all of the traffic and minor criminal cases, most of which are payable, we believe we could handle about half of those. It still is very, very significant because, as we're going to talk about in a minute, we collect and distribute to our justice partners, not just the general fund, but our municipal partners, roughly $200 million a year. And if we cut half of those cases that produce all this revenue, we would lose about $100 million in money that we send to our justice partners. Now, the next slide talks about the collateral effects on local government and state. I'm in a county that has 47 municipal partners, and we've gone through all the money that we send to these municipal partners. There are a number of municipal partners that don't get any local government aid under the formula. For example, we send $910,000 a year to Edina, $990,000 a year to Bloomington, and many of our justice partners. If we stop doing those L's on the list, then all that is going to dry up. That all you have to do is put pen to paper to see how many firefighters or policemen or people in the planning department at a city like Bloomington would be on the chopping block if we could not continue to send them that revenue stream. Minneapolis, we send $8,700,000 out of Hennepin County alone. Out of Hennepin County alone, last year we sent the general fund $35 million. All of that is in jeopardy if we stop doing the L's or a large portion of them. If the public defenders are cut and we have further cuts with our staff, the criminal system, what we do is going to back up. That leads to increased jail costs, overcrowding. We talked about the possibility of having to close our suburban courthouses. In Hennepin County, the courthouse that handles the least number of cases per year in the suburbs handles over 28,000 cases. That's going to have very serious impact on those municipalities. Is instead of being their police officers being able to drive down the block, get in and out of court, they're going to be coming down to downtown Minneapolis. We don't even have any courthouses or courtrooms for the judges we have, let alone bringing back over 100,000 cases a year from the suburbs.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge, could you just explain, I'm missing something here. How does this interact with the payables? I mean, aren't you already not doing these cases, but still the revenue, if they're payables, presumably the revenue's still coming in? I don't quite get how this fits together.
Judge Clancy.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Madam Representative. Hennepin County does a lot of payables. Outstate Minnesota doesn't do nearly as many, but in addition to the payables, we still process lots of misdemeanors that are not payable, or somebody requests a court hearing, so there's still a very high volume. When we talk about our courts out in the suburbs, for example, the morning calendar might have 110, 125 cases a day. Those are not payable. Those are cases that we're handling that drive a lot of these revenues.
Yes. Chair, if I might just add to that, and Representative Liebling, all of these payables, we're talking about the payables list is whether there's a mandatory court appearance. The payables are the money coming in, the tickets that are getting paid. Somebody is opening up all those envelopes and taking those checks out and entering the information into the computer and distributing the money. That's what we're talking about. We're not going to have the staff to do all that if we get a cut of the magnitude that's being described. And in terms of the priorities, you're looking at the list of what are the things that we would, if we were going to continue doing all of those payables, then what on the other part of the list won't we do in order to deal with the staff shortages? I mean, that's what the issue is here. So we're trying to reduce the workload through increasing the numbers that are on the payables list. And later on in the presentation, we're going to talk more about this access and service delivery initiative, which is trying to automate that to reduce the cost. But for right now, where we're at is that there's staff that are doing manually processing all of those cases. That's 1.2 million cases that are being handled. Somebody's taking time to do all of that, and if you don't have the staff, then we have to make some choices about what we're not going to be able to get done.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding you then, you're talking about not doing cases that you're already processing as payable. So what's on this list is not, you know, you're not talking about taking things out of court that are now going through court. You're talking about not doing payables, a lot of this, that you're now processing just as payables. Is that what I'm understanding?
Judge Radenberg.
Thank you, Chairman Samar and Representative Liebling. Yes, those are payables that are currently coming into the courts, as Sue said, 1.2 million of them per year. They are, given our processes currently, they require a lot of hands-on staff involvement to process. I mean, the money is coming in the mail, but as Sue said, someone's got to enter that, create a Minsons record, receipt the money. We're looking at, in the access and service delivery initiatives, streamlining that process so that we can do it with less labor, in less labor-intensive manners. But currently, we haven't, our justice partners haven't the ability to do all the things that we need in order to do things in that fashion. So if we lose the staff that's being discussed, we have to stop doing something. We can't stop doing in custody cases. We can't stop doing bail hearings. We can't stop doing speedy trial demands. We stop the lowest level, or slow down at least, the lowest level of priority, which in many instances is the payable offenses.
Mr. Chair, could I respond to that?
Just
to show you something that you can take a look at, this list we've got of the high, medium, and low. If you notice at the bottom, We had case filings of 1,939,000 last year. The minor criminal alone represented 1,500,000 of that. I've got over 500 employees in the Hennepin County Court, most of whom do nothing but process cases. And those are the bodies that are going to be gone if we take this 5 or 10% cut. We won't have the people to process all the cases that we do.
Representative Lee, Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, a comment and a question for the testifiers. First, members, for purposes of clarification, when we talk about creating payables, we're talking about decriminalization. And I know that that's a pejorative term in some people's minds. And I know the courts are talking about doing this because they have to. They don't have the staff. But to be clear, we're turning misdemeanors into petty misdemeanors. So things which would qualify for jail time, you can just pay them. For example, I have people who are driving with no insurance and smashing into someone every other month. At some point, when you keep doing that, you go to jail. If it's no insurance becomes a payable, it's effectively a petty misdemeanor, no jail time. It just keeps on going. So that's one of the costs. And again, I'm not accusing the courts of anything. I'm doing this. It's just a fact, something that's going to happen. In light of that kind of situation and that kind of problem starting to occur, do you, Ms. Dosal, or either of the judges, I know the courts have a certain measure of official immunity when it comes to people having problems with how you decide to do these vis-a-vis your budget. However, have you considered any repercussions of lawsuits for injunctive relief, or when this stuff goes down, you guys impose this, have you considered anything happening with respect to litigation? You could potentially be subject to someone asking for an order that you guys do things differently. I know that's kind of vague, but I know that's going to come up once things change for the judiciary. Have you considered that?
Mr. Saul?
Well, I'll take a crack at it, and then I'll ask the other two to respond, too. We're here telling you that we cannot do all of what is constitutionally required, statutorily required, mostly constitutionally required, if a cut of the magnitude that's being suggested happens. So, and we're going around the state, the Chief Justice is going around the state saying the same thing. He's got law enforcement and county attorneys and the whole panoply of justice system folks with him, alerting the public, the legislature, and the governor that this is what would happen, what we have to do. We cannot do all the work that that comes in our door. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says that we are to handle both civil and criminal cases promptly and without delay. One consequence may be more of what we saw last week when the Court of Appeals dismissed the case, the defendant in the case, for failure to meet the speedy trial demand. That is one outlet on the criminal side. And obviously litigation could happen. On the civil side, litigation can happen. These are individual rights guaranteed by the Constitution. On the civil side, as well as on the criminal side, that's in jeopardy here, and that's what we're seeing. On the payables list, what we're saying with this kind of a cut, a 5 or 10% cut, it's not just that the money doesn't come in. It means that certain, as Representative Lesch indicated, that certain cases just are not going to get processed. There will be no consequence for shoplifting, trespass, worthless check, all of those. We're saying that the rule of law is in jeopardy here. And there undoubtedly will be litigation. There's been litigation in other parts of the state or the country, and undoubtedly there would be. But that's my first crack at it.
Judge Rodenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Lesch. I would echo what Sue says. The analysis that we've done thus far at the council level is not so much related to liability, but rather an analysis that literally, in some of these instances, the rule of law is at stake. Mankato has experienced a number of tragic situations involving underage drinking in the past few years. If we are going to operate within the budget parameters that are proposed by the governor, underage drinking will be a payable offense. I think it's fair to say that law enforcement and the Minnesota State University Mankato have significant concerns about that, that go beyond some liability theoretically of a judge or court administrator, but rather to the lives of young people attending school in my district.
Representative Judge, Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh,
we're aware that there are lawsuits in other parts of the country that pit different players. New York, the judiciary and the legislature are at loggerheads. What we're trying to do is be very upfront and give you all the information you need to make the decision so that we don't get involved in some type of constitutional crisis at any level. I'm convinced, we started this in July in Hennepin County, that we can help you if you know fully what's going on in the courts and what might happen based upon the cuts. And we're hoping, obviously, to obviate that and avoid that challenge.
Representative Kelly.
Could I just do follow-up briefly, Mr. Chair?
Representative Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for clarifications, I appreciate the answers of each of you. And I know that, as I say that, I didn't say that in an accusatory way, but the three of you are credible on this, and hearing those responses, I think, is important for the record. So thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification, I guess, if we're looking at a 5 or 10% budget reduction, and the items that you've listed out here would be a reduction of $1.6 million of the filings, the correlation there, does that mean only 5% of our staff or 10% of our staff are doing all of the work with those filings?
Judge Swenson.
On the second page of the document that you have that shows those high, medium, low is a pie chart which shows you the staff need by case level priority. The medium high priority cases require about 74% of the staff, the low priority about 26% of the staff. I hope that answers your question.
Did you want to rephrase that a different way, Representative Kelly? It sounds like you're not getting your answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I see the difference in time. It just doesn't seem to correlate between reducing it by 1.6 million filings and the reduction of only 5, 10%.
Mr. Stahl.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, you look at that pie chart here, and what it shows is that of the total number of cases that we have, only about 12% of the cases in numbers are this medium and high. These are the serious criminal, family, probate, the like. 88% in numbers are these low volume cases, those low cases, the payable cases, the 1.6 you're talking about. But when you look at the bottom in terms of how we deploy our staff, that 12% medium high category actually takes 74% of our staff time. So that's how this gets translated.
Representative Kelly.
But then we would be reducing our lower level by 25%. From a time savings, it appears. So I'm just wondering, again, from a 5% or 10% reduction, how that matches up.
Well, Mr. Chair, all I can tell you is we take $29 million and we divide it by the average cost of an employee, and that's how it works out. And then we're taking the number of cases based on what the allocation of staff to those case types are and the cost of that, and that's how we're arriving at this number.
Thank you. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge Swenson, in full disclosure, I do work for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Just thought I'd say that. I have the same concerns. Thanks, Representative Lesh. I have the same concern as Representative Lesh when it comes to payables, just so that I'm clear. What if a particular person habitually was getting underage, if you implemented this, was getting underage consumption or habitually shoplifting? Would I mean, would have, how would that impact the idea of payables or decriminalization?
Judge Clemson.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Madam Representative. Senator Foley has a bill that where he wants an infraction label put on this, but he recognizes that repeat offenses may have to be moved up to misdemeanor level and outside of the infraction. So that's one possible way that people have thought about handling that issue with your concern.
Thank you. But in statute, we have different thresholds for property crimes like theft, you know, the various thresholds for loss. So I guess, and there's obviously enhancement if it's a repeat offender. So I guess what I'm asking is in relation to how you're going to shift jurisdictions as well. I mean, I guess I'm wondering about the implementation of the program. I guess I have concerns, much like Representative Rush has, about how that would impact the system as a whole doing this. It seems like it'd be a little bit more convoluted.
Judge Clemson.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative. The implementation, if we have to go down this path of the lows and stopping doing the lows, could well be an order from the Chief Judge to prevent the filing of those. So that we wouldn't even see them. The problem we've got is we recognize your concern, and we've met with all of our justice partners, and they've expressed their concern. It's a simple matter of our not having the staff to do it. If we'll cut 5% or 10%, as much as we'd like to, we live in the communities on a day-to-day basis, as everybody else does. We understand that if you don't prosecute quickly minor level offenses, then that can lead to ramped up criminal behavior. We're aware of that, but we're sitting here trying to respond to you in an honest way and tell you what we'll be able to do with the staff that we've got if we take a big hit. It's not a pretty picture, but it's the reality.
Representative Haas and Liebling.
Thank you very much. I had a question, maybe in a 3x5 card answer for Representative Lesch. Isn't there categories of, like, without proof of insurance and without insurance? Isn't that kind of like two separate issues? And if people are repeating this now under a criminal offense, what we have is that not proof that what we have is really not working anyway? There's a multiple question for it.
Yes, yes, and the repeat factor of it, Representative Haas, is that you start getting jail time. For example, it's bench guidelines, you can get 90 days in jail right now as it is, well, unless we turn into a payable. But as it is, for example, driving after revocation, the scoff laws where you have a long list of people that keep driving without a license, in Ramsey County, bench guideline, if you give them 15 days on number 4, with and then they just you start stacking 3 days for every subsequent offense. So I get people where we're just executing sentences on driving afters. And then you've got the insurance violations where we'll give 15 days on a number 3, and then I will, as a recommendation, stack 5 or 10 days for every violation thereafter. So at a certain point, when you start looking at real jail time, it is a disincentive to continue driving without insurance.
Thank you. Just a follow-up then. What about just, you know, the proof of insurance should have been in my glove compartment but wasn't? I mean, isn't that, you know, in an entirely different situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, that's one of those things that they're trying to do. What they do, they've dealt with that in Hennepin right now. You can show it in 10 days as it is right now, and we just wipe it. There's nothing there. We dismiss it. No prosecution. I can tell you that as a matter of policy, I know our office in St. Paul, if you even show up afterwards and you can show that you did have insurance, even though it's technically still a crime, you had to have it in your car, you had to show proof, we don't prosecute those, so they don't even go through.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Levine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't help but comment following up on that, you know, I'm not sure putting them in jail helps anyway. So, sure, they go to jail eventually and all that, but I mean, I think, you know, I'd like to see the studies on how effective that is as a strategy to actually get people to be insured and so on. But anyway, my question really, going back to our testifiers here, I'm looking at these pie charts again and your answers to Representative Kelly. I thought those were very good questions that he had. And the question that comes to my mind when I look at these pie charts is, you know, what have you done or what are you going to suggest us to do to reduce the time that goes into that small slice of high priority cases so that you're not using 74% of your staff time on 12% of your cases? And I understand the difference. I know what's in those cases, but yet I have to say that every time I'm in a courtroom, I wonder why you got all those people in the courtroom. I still don't really get it. It just seems to me that there have got to be lots of things we can do to make those cases run smoother.
Mr. Chair, if I might, that's a great segue, and I'm going to go out of order for our presentation because we have judges here that come from a long way, and I'm trying at least to get John Lornberg here. So we're going to skip to that very thing. We're going to talk about, this would be slide 17 in your outline. It's we're talking next, we're going to be talking about our positive request for 10-11. And this was put together, obviously, before the economic meltdown last fall. But this particular targeted technology investment request, it was about $5.5 million, is to support the very thing that Representative Liebling is just questioning us about. And I'm going to turn this over to Judge Rodner.
Let me, before you do that, I should have been paying attention more to the time here because we're going to have you back on Thursday. Are your other three witnesses here and will not be able to be here on Thursday? I wonder if we should give them an opportunity to...
Well, we have the same problem. We have Judge Rodenberg has got a full calendar on Thursday, and so we're going to have to just see what we can do. Probably not.
Go ahead. They're not going to be available.
Well, we may not be able to, but we'll just have to do what we can do. I think this is probably the...
Judge Rodenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Liebling, that was, as Sue said, that was an excellent segue to the very discussion that we wanted to have with you. And I'm going to try and go through it somewhat expeditiously to try and be respectful of the time of the committee. But we started looking at this before last fall. In fact, last February, the council heard from state economist Tom Stinson, and I know you've heard from Mr. Stinson as well, about how the budget problem is not just a short-term issue, but is a long-term problem driven by demographic shifts that are happening now and are going to continue to happen with the aging population. In response to what we heard from Mr. Stinson, the Judicial Council formed the Access and Service Delivery Committee, which I chaired. We met from February through the early summer of 2008 to develop strategies for restructuring court delivery systems, redesigning business processes, expanding the use of technology, and prioritizing functions to provide appropriate levels of access and service at the lowest cost and continuing to provide service to the members of the public in different ways. By way of analogy, and I will make this brief, but our system as it currently exists, and Representative Liebling is making reference to this, we look like the bank looked when I was a teenager, and I would get my paper check from the Kaiserhof, and I would walk it down to the Farmers and Merchants Bank, and I would stand in line, and there were, you know, 10 counters, and all they were manned by people, and there was a whole bunch of people in the bank lobby as we handled these pieces of paper. That's how our systems look currently. By analogy, the banking system looks a lot different nowadays. I get my check from the state every 2 weeks. I'm pleased with that, but I don't see it. I don't get a piece of paper. It's done electronically. Likewise, if I want to get money out of the bank, I am not limited to the bank hours. I'm able to access, sometimes with the assistance of a teenager child of mine, but I can figure out how to use the ATM machine and get money out of the bank. I could have. I didn't this morning, but I could have gotten money from the bank without seeing anyone and before banking hours. So that's the model that the Access and Service Delivery Committee is looking at, is looking at expanding the level of service and the hours of service by the use of technology. That, of course, can't be done in an overnight fashion. We can't flip the switch on that. The recommended options emanating from the ASD committee, the Access and Service Delivery Committee, were staffing to the most efficient norm, re-engineering the workflow in an electronic environment, pursuing appropriate legislative and court policy reform, and looking at structural and governance issues. As to that last bullet point, we have 10 judicial districts throughout the state of Minnesota, each of which has its own and full administration. We've done a little bit with that already. The 7th and 8th judicial districts share a district administrator, and there appear to us to be ways of, by sharing and changing governance, being more efficient in the future. The first recommendation is to staff our trial courts to the most efficient norm. Currently, we allocate a higher ratio of staff to judge need in a small court than in a large court. As an example, Judge Swenson's court is the most efficient, is in the most efficient court, the largest courts. The smaller courts, where there are one and less weighted case load judge need, there is more staff because the staff in the paper environment is unable to achieve the efficiencies that can be achieved in a larger court. This recommendation focuses on our need as a system to improve those ratios or norms by developing strategies that allow the smaller courts to function at an efficiency level commensurate with the larger courts in the state. As we've talked about, 2 million cases are filed each year, and of those, 1.2 million are citations. Most of those citations are payable. If we were to centralize the processing of payables and standardizing our collection process to turn over old debt in a systematic way and to use hearing officers as opposed to judges for fine mitigation, we can obtain significant economies in staff and judge time. Significant parts of this approach are already being done, as Judge Swenson indicated, in Hennepin County with the hearing officer system. If we use interactive television or ITV coupled with hearing officers, we could centralize or regionalize these lower case types and allow the smaller courts or more rural parts of the state to take advantage of some of these same efficiencies. To divert work from court administration staff and in order to staff to the most efficient norm, we think our virtual statewide virtual self-help center needs to expand and be more widely promoted. When people come to the counter pro se or in need of assistance, who do they talk to? They talk to the court administration staff. If we're going to be attempting to decrease the staffing in the smaller courts, we have to have an answer for those citizens. And that would be by promoting and advancing the statewide virtual self-help center. We do already have terminals in the 87 counties, and we're relying on the specialized staff from Hennepin County to assist people in remote parts of the state or in rural parts of the state with their needs. Finally, to achieve the most efficient norm, we need to achieve greater efficiency by redesigning the courtroom duties among the court reporter, law clerk, and court administration staff, with expanded technology and business practice changes that can reduce the cost of this function. A second area of recommendation is workflow reengineering. We're currently working on centralizing the paper processing of payables, and that would achieve some efficiencies. But we're also in the midst of testing several pilots. Up until now, we've been doing this sort of on an as-we-can or as-possible basis. But we're going to be more aggressive with that with what we call the trifecta. That is e-citation, electronic citation in the squad car, transfer of the information from law enforcement directly to Mintus, that is our case management system, which would automatically open a case and populate the record based upon the information coming to us from law enforcement. Auto-assess, which is using Mintus and the technologies we have currently available to do the very complicated splits, and we talked a little bit about that earlier, but what portion of that goes to the general fund, what portion goes to the local agency. And that can be done automatically. If we can implement an interactive voice recognition or interactive web payment, people could go online or by using the touchpad on their telephone, using a credit card or debit card, make payment without coming to the courthouse and without using the mails. And then if payment is not made, auto referral out for collection. In this model, you can go all the way from the citation all the way through closing of the case without anyone touching the file in court administration. Representative Liebling, this goes directly to the subject you're talking about. Absolutely. The systems we're using currently are very labor-intensive. This model would reduce that labor, would maximize the use of technologies so that money and tickets and information can flow into and actually out of the court system with minimal human interaction. We also know that we're going to be having to move to e-documents, e-calendaring, and e-noticing in the more paperless environment. Our experts tell us that we can achieve significant increases in productivity, and automating these 1.2 million payables each year lays the foundation to do that in the future. Centralizing and automating, I'm going to go through this slide fairly quickly, but centralizing and automating payable citations, moving toward e-filing, e-charging, e-complaints, and calendaring, and then centralizing other services such as traffic. Probate is an area we think we can actually improve service to the public by centralizing or regionalizing that service, taking a closer look at those cases, which is going to be more important with the aging population. Conciliation court, child support, and other mandated services. We're rethinking how we do business, in other words, and we're well on our way to doing some of these things already. The third change request that we're making, then, is for targeted technology investments needed to accomplish the ASD reengineering efforts to cut those labor costs. This includes automating the payable citation processing. On the front end, we want to expand the amount of e-citations we get from law enforcement. If we can get those, as I said, if we can get those electronically, it cuts our staff costs and reduce errors in entry of information into MNSIS. Approximately 20% of our criminal filings are currently coming in electronically, and we want to increase that as much as possible. We get, as the court system gets a significant amount of the benefit of e-citations. In other words, law enforcement populates the record, and we get the benefit if we can do that electronically. Consequently, it makes sense to incent law enforcement to do those things so that we can save on our end the labor costs. We are asking for $1 million in one-time money for grants to law enforcement to give those agencies an incentive to do what I'm talking about so that the information can come electronically into our system. The remainder of this piece is for e-citation licenses and staff to support the computer enhancements and business process changes to centralize and redesign process. Reengineering and automating how these 1.2 million cases are handled in 99 locations across the state from 1,000 law enforcement offices with a complex statutory scheme will require an initial investment to achieve timely payback in both reduced labor costs. By the end of the biennium, we estimate 35 to 40 positions, $2 million of ongoing savings, and with needed legislative changes to simplify the fine and fee distributions, we believe we can increase revenues in this biennium by over $5 million. The second piece of this is a request for $2.2 million to increase bandwidth and network support for increased data, voice, and video transmissions, especially in outstate Minnesota. Remember that the process we're talking about is to allow the smaller regions, the less populated regions, to take advantage of some of these efficiencies of scale, but those are also the portions of the state that will most need increased bandwidth to be able to cover the things we're talking about. So we're going to need funding to bring up to speed the infrastructure and the bandwidth in those areas to allow for expanded use of ITV, telephone interpreting, transmission of digital images, and other things to allow us to staff to the most efficient norm, as I indicated at the outset. The entirety of the ASD report, I believe, has been included in the materials given you. It's a fairly lengthy report, and I can't do it justice in 5 minutes, but if you have questions about details of it, I would be glad to answer those. It's just a quick run through our request.
Good. I appreciate the work and the report. We're running out of time here, but I just quick question on your presentation. So you're requesting $5.6 million for these targeted technology investments. Where do we see as a committee the projected cost savings from implementing all of these?
soon.
Mr. Saul.
Mr. Chair, this cannot be done overnight, so we're not going to be able to take down these costs, but we, by the end of the biennium, we're talking about, from the court standpoint, that decreasing somewhere between, you know, about 40 to 50 positions in that territory. We're talking, that's about $2.5 to $3 million reduction in costs that we would have. And then on top of it, as Judge Rundberg indicated, we have this package, which we hope you'll be offering, of fine simplification and collections all together with the payables is going to produce significant new revenues for the state general fund now in this next biennium, as well as in an ongoing way, and but also for the other aspects of the of government, counties, cities, state patrol and the like, that benefit from the splits that come from these fines. So it's a very big package.
Yes,
we think this investment up front will really reduce our costs and increase revenue to the state.
Can you would you be able to provide something that would document those projections out so we can see what we're getting for our investment? It all seems like a good thing to do, but Judge?
Mr. Chairman, I think some of that information you will find in the ASD report itself. I am not immediately able to come up with the number, but I think if we can achieve staffing to the most efficient norm, the expectation is we can decrease the number of staff by 126, as I recall it. Is that sort of like
minus those that would be needed to do the central work. So,
somewhere
you get to 40 to 50 positions.
Yeah, so some of that information is there, and I can't retrieve it immediately, but there are significant staff savings if we can staff to the most efficient norm statewide.
And review that on Thursday. Judge Swenson, Judge Roddenberg, Mr. Saul, thank you for coming. One thing, Mr. Saul, I don't know if you can provide this by Thursday, but is there any way that you can at least let the court, let this committee know what if there's anything in the Obama stimulus package that would help the court system? I'm thinking specifically about the Byrd grants, and maybe we can fund some of our drug courts in the during the crisis here, and then use that money to help some of the holes in your budget. I don't know, but that would be helpful for us at the hearing.
Sure, we'll do that.
Thank you very much. Members, this committee meeting is adjourned.